This is the Quality News Network. In Washington, D.C., the U.S. Justice Department will take a new look at a dormant inquiry into the federal warrantless wiretap program. Rekindling of the investigation indicates a major shift in policy just days after new Attorney General Michael Mukasey took office. Investigators were denied security clearance last year, forcing the inquiry to be shelved. $1.6 trillion is the cost a Democratic committee has put on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. A report released today includes so-called hidden costs, like long-term health care for veterans and interest payments on money borrowed to fight the war. The U.S. military is pulling 3,000 soldiers out of the Diyala province, taking the edge off of last summer's controversial 30,000 troop increase. Most of the brigade will be home by Christmas. Four Turkish soldiers were killed in battles with Kurdistan Workers' Party guerrillas as Turkey sent special forces to the region bordering northern Iraq. Turkish officials have threatened an incursion into northern Iraq to root out rebels using the mountains as a base for further border attacks. Two people were killed, 10 injured when a bomb exploded at the Philippines House of Representatives. The blast killed Congressman Wahab Akbar, who reportedly had ties to an Islamic extremist group. Iran is handing over a set of blueprints showing how to mold uranium metal into the shape of warheads. The release of the documents meets a key demand of the UN nuclear agency. While an upcoming UN report may say that Iran is cooperating, it may not be enough to stop the call for a third set of UN sanctions against that country. South Korea is asking the U.S., China, and North Korea to begin negotiations aimed at producing an official peace treaty to replace the armistice ending the Korean War 5 decades ago. Israeli President Shimon Peres and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas are both in agreement that the upcoming Middle Eastern peace conference is an historic opportunity and that failing to reach agreement would mean more trouble for that region. The conference is set for Annapolis, Maryland, later this year. And Pakistani police rounding up supporters of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, throwing them in jail, saying they're violating the government's ban on public gatherings. You're listening to the Quality News Network. We'll take a look at science and business news just ahead.
Civility takes an effort. It requires that people remember that relationships need our attention. Whether we are talking about our most important personal relationships, how we get along with our colleagues, or the way we interact with strangers, it is what we contribute that defines the results. Even when the other people are not prepared to give their best selves, what we put in determines what we get out. Ralph Waldo Emerson suggested, we must be as courteous to a man as we are to a picture, which we are willing to give the advantage of a good light. This is the essence of civility. When we are civil to strangers, when we defer at the intersection instead of racing out ahead, when we hold the door for someone we don't know, when we smile at someone who catches our eye, we declare our choice for a civilized society. For more information, click on the Civility button on our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com.
The world's smallest bear faces extinction. Poaching and deforestation in its southeastern Asian home put the sun bear in the vulnerable category by the World Conservation Union. An estimated 10,000 sun bears remain on Earth, their habitat stretching from India to Indonesia. In business, President Bush vetoed legislation which would fund job training, education, and health programs. It is the sixth veto of his administration and the latest in a battle with Democratic Congress over domestic spending. Mr. Bush says the current U.S. economy remains strong despite taking some recent hits. He cited higher oil prices and a sagging housing market during a TV interview on Fox Business News this morning. Mr. Bush says he expects the U.S. dollar to, quote, rise on the back of a resilient economy. The nation's biggest retailer, Walmart, announcing third-quarter profit rising almost 8%, beating estimates. International sales also increased 17%. Company raised its full-year outlook heading into the holidays. Bank of America will take a $3 billion write-down in the fourth quarter, warning its losses could eventually be even worse. Light sweet crude oil trading at $91.17 a barrel. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow way up 319 points to end at 13,307. NASDAQ up 89 points. S&P 500 also up 41. More at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Give me confidence, Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 70 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network. Please stop by headonradionetwork.com, and there you'll see a PayPal button, and you can make a small donation there and keep the network's packets passing and the streamers streaming and the promos playing and all the things that are done at the Head On Radio Network. These contributions that you make are strictly for keeping the essential computers and the streams and the T1 lines and that sort of thing paid for. All of the hosts have day jobs, and we do not take any of those funds. In fact, I even contribute to that fund also. I wouldn't ask you to do anything I wouldn't do. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is November the 13th. It's a Tuesday. And so if you are listening at a little after 9 p.m. on a Tuesday evening on November 13th, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you are welcome to call in. If you are listening to one of our archive streams in the future, then you're still welcome to the show, but obviously you can't call it live. The telephone number is 877, the number 4, Head On. That's 877, the number 4, Head On. That translates into 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, please use that, and you can save the studio a nickel or a buck. That's 304-658-3333, 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. That's Peter at headonradionetwork.com. And I do try to check the mail during the breaks if you choose to communicate with the show in that way. Also, the show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com. There you'll find links to all of the guests, and you'll find links to the audio archives from the past shows, as well as to the chat room, which is active as I speak. I'm keeping an eye on it. You'll find links to the Head On Radio Network main site, where you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, of which Strictly Confidential is a small part, and we are proud to be a part. There are links there also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page, and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. This is an interesting week for guests. We have some wonderful guests lined up, and tonight is absolutely no exception. I'm very pleased to have two guests this evening. We have Christine Bake and Peterson Toscano. They will be joining us in just a few moments. Christine spent 4 years in the ex-gay movement, or the recovery-type programs, attempting to alter her sexual orientation through reparative therapy, in addition to receiving pastoral counseling and discipleship training. She attended ex-gay programs including Where Grace Abounds in Denver and the Living Waters program. In April 2007, she joined with Peter Toscano, who is our other guest, as founding members of the co-founding members of Beyond Ex-Gay. Christine Bake has been in Glamour magazine and featured her experiences as an ex-gay survivor. She's appeared on ABC's Good Morning America, on Colorado Public Radio, and on Sirius OutQ. She's one of the key organizers of Ex-Gay. And, in fact, both she and Peterson have just returned from the Ex-Gay Survivors Conference, which was held just a few days ago in Colorado, I believe. There is video of that conference. I have posted the video link at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. I encourage you to have a look at it. If you go to strictlyconfidentialradio.com, I'm just checking. I'm sorry, checking a note from production. If you go to strictlyconfidentialradio.com, you'll go to today's calendar date, and you'll see that both Christine Bake and Peter Toscano are listed as this evening's guests. You'll also see a link there to a must-see video, and that must-see video is the 2007 Ex-Gay Survivor Conference. Jeff Lutz was there. I saw him as a speaker. Jeff Lutz, of course, has been one of our guests in the past from Soul Force. Regarding Peterson Toscano, he's a playwright, an actor, and a gay activist. He spent nearly decades. Trust me, guys, I will get this together tonight. I'm multitasking at the moment, I guess you can tell. He spent nearly two decades in the ex-gay movement attempting to alter his sexual orientation through reparative therapy. In addition to receiving pastoral counseling and discipleship training, he attended several ex-gay programs, including Life Ministries in New York, and the residential ex-gay program Love in Action in Memphis, Tennessee. He currently resides in Hartford, Connecticut. He also is, in 2003, premiered his one-man show. It's a one-man satire called Doing Time in the Homo Nomo Halfway House. This has been well-received, and in fact, this performance that he does has been compared to Whoopi Goldberg's earlier one-woman shows. In fact, I have a 30-second clip from him doing his Doing Time in the Homo Nomo Halfway House, which we'll get to later in the evening. His other works include Queer 101 and How the Indians Discovered Columbus and the Re-Education of George W. Bush. He is also listed as being a Quaker minister, and that he has a nonviolent approach in his work to exposing injustice to the anti-gay oppressors without violence. And so I'm not sure. Yes, excellent. I do see now that we had a keyboard issue just as the show started. Keyboards begin sending out random characters. And so production chat was a little interesting there. It was like E-D-Y-U-X-X-R-D, you know the drill. So anyway, I think we have that back. Yes, in fact, we do. And I see that both of the guests are with us now. Christine and Peterson, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay, Peterson?
I can hear you fine. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. You sound great. And Christine, are you with us?
I certainly am.
Are you able to hear Peterson and myself okay? I need to check these things at the beginning.
Perfectly, yes.
Wonderful. I'm so glad to hear that. I'm so pleased to have you two on the show. We should probably start with the most important issue, and that is, Peterson, you can tap dance?
Yeah, I was a crazy kid, wanted to totally get into theater, and I got into a theater troupe, and one of the requirements was to learn how to tap dance. Yeah. Not
no,
a marketable
I thought that
skill
was
anymore, but, you know.
Priceless. In fact, I want to say to everyone listening, their website is a treasure. The website which we are currently posting in chat is, one moment, I'm bringing up my main site, is beyondxgay.com, if I'm correct. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's no, or yes, I believe there is a space. Is it beyond ex-gay or just
no, no
ex-gay?
No space. It's just beyondxgay.com, no space.
Excellent. The site is wonderful. You'll find testimonies there from many, many people who have been through the ex-gay programs or reparative therapies, which are, of course, a nightmare. Peterson and Christine, we have on this show talked about this in great length in past shows. You two will be the first guests who've talked to us with any great understanding of it. We've run the audio that we clipped out of some video from people speaking in front of NARTH. We've run the audio of some of the former ex-gay leaders who were apologizing to the LGBT community regarding the what has happened and the damage that they have caused. Peterson, you spent almost 20 years of your life involved in this.
Yeah, that's right. I got involved when I was 17, shortly after I became a born-again evangelical Christian, and it was made very clear to me by my minister that in order for me to be a good Christian, I could not be gay. And although I never really lived a gay lifestyle, I mean, I always had attractions, I knew I needed to repent of those attractions, and that began a quest to do anything and everything in my power to suppress and even possibly change my sexual orientation. And it took me all over the place. It took me to England. It took me to Ecuador. I went to got help in Colorado and New York and Memphis, and I was desperate. I was desperate for a cure. I would do anything to fix that problem.
Well, Peterson, my heart goes out to you. The only thing I can compare it to in my lifetime is I went through 15 years of drug addiction, 15 years on the wrong side of a crack pipe. This is no secret from my listeners. I share many personal things about my life. And that's old news now. That all ended back in the year 2000. But nonetheless, those years are gone forever. I spent about 15 years, and it's like a huge hole in my life. Does it feel that way to you, too?
It does in some ways. I mean, I spent tens of thousands of dollars, I mean, enough to easily put a down payment on a house, on, you know, the treatments that I got. And it also deeply wounded my family. My parents got dragged in at one point into the therapy, and they were pretty well blamed for making me gay, and that it was all about family dysfunction that made it happen. And so they were deeply wounded, and I had wanted to be an actor, you know, since I was little, and I went to college to be an actor, and when I realized that I was studying theater in New York and it was just loaded with gay guys, I felt I needed to lay that down too, and I stopped acting. I put down all these parts of my life, shoved it all in the closet, and pursued this other course that nearly destroyed me. And there was definitely a time in my life that I was suicidal over the whole thing. And I lived in New York City, and I stood on the subway platform for 2 weeks, going to work, coming back, wondering, what is this going to feel like when I jump in front of the train? It wasn't
Wow.
even a matter of if I jump. It was just, this is inevitable because there's no solution here. And it's just, it's just really, really very painful experience to go through that and to do that to your loved ones as well.
Well, Peterson, I understand there's a lot to say about parents being drug into this, and we certainly want to get into that. Christine, how did this come to you? How did this whole reparative theory enter your life?
Well, I had heard about it back. It was interesting because when I was going to attend, I was wanting to go down to, I lived in Northern California, and I wanted to go down to the University of California at Santa Cruz to finish my degree. And my parents didn't want me to go. And they said, one of the things they said is that there had been this group that had come to the church, which I had known that they had come to my parents' church, and it was an ex-gay group. It was actually, funnily, kind of amusing, with this connection with Peterson, it was the original Love in Action program in San Rafael, which was the original, I believe the original location. Is that right, Peterson?
That's correct.
Yeah. So it was actually that group, so this would have been in 93, came to my parents' church in Northern California and spoke there. And my parents were concerned. They thought I was gay. And so they went up and talked to them, and, you know, and I guess my parents had talked to them. And the people said, well, if she wants to go to UC Santa Cruz, then she's definitely a lesbian. Because I guess Santa Cruz is known for, you know, being very pro-lesbian, you know, kind of girl lesbian environment.
I see. In Florida, so, I didn't pick up that detail, so that's an interesting aspect.
Yeah, so when I told my parents, you know, I want to go to UCSB and finish my degree, they were like, well, yeah, she's a lesbian. And I wasn't even, you know, I was still struggling it out to myself at the time, so they confronted me with this, you know, we think you're a lesbian, and this group sort of confirmed it for us, and because you want to go to UCSB, and, you know, of course I denied it, and said, oh, how could you, I have a boyfriend, what are you talking about? So, oddly enough, I mean, that was kind of the first that I sort of knew a little bit about it, that there was, you know, this program of people who said they weren't gay anymore, but, you know, that was pretty much the extent of my exposure. And then when I, you know, I came out in 94, and about 4 years later was when Exodus and some of these other groups were starting to be very public with advertising. And so they were coming out with ads, you know, if you love someone, you know, if you love someone, you'll tell them the truth. You know, that they don't have to stay homosexual, that they can be set free, that kind of thing. John and Ann Polk had just come out in advertising and with books saying that they had been set free from homosexuality. So, you know, this all kind of dovetailed with a sort of a religious conversion experience I had had, or a reconversion experience I had had. I was at the time sort of seeking to reconcile myself with my former Christianity again. And so that's kind of what looped me all back into it again, and this really looked like an option for me. And so that's kind of how I got kind of wrapped up in it. And so I researched things, and I was reading some of the material, and there were, you know, you had mentioned that you had played some audio or something of I think a press conference that was out
yes,
in front of
there were
North.
Several. Yes, it was in front of North. There were a number of people. It was it was a rally of sorts in front of North, and the people were asking the fellow who's in charge, whose name I don't have in front of me, but you probably know, to come out and address them. But of course, he refused to see them, and they were telling individual stories about the years and the dollars that they had put into this, and the wasted time and what a scam is the word that I use. You mentioned public advertising, and you know they advertise because this is a huge moneymaker. You'll probably would agree with me on that.
Yeah, I believe that was a part of our Survivor Initiative, which was kind of a follow-up to our conference, and was something we did with SilForce. SilForce, the equal rights, anti-violent. Here's going to help me out.
Yeah, with the ex-gay survivor conference that was held actually this past June, some of the other events that we organized with SilForce was this public apology of former Exodus leaders that you referred to, Peter. And then in July, we had ex-gay survivors, SilForce organized ex-gay survivors to go around the country to various places to tell their stories. And Christine made these beautiful collages using excerpts from people's journals and photographs, and you can see them, these collages, on Beyond Ex Gay under resources, and you'll see collages. And we framed these collages and gave them to the people at NARS and at Love and Action in Memphis and at New Life Church in Colorado Springs and the Southern Baptist Convention headquarters at the program up in Salt Lake City that the Mormons run, Evergreen. And we wanted them to see that there's another story that you're not hearing. There are people who have been through these programs that you cared for, but now are saying that actually the experience caused them more harm than good, and you need to consider their story.
Christine, how in the beginning did you meet Peterson and the two of you decide to begin this? It's become extremely successful and well-known. How did this begin?
Well, you know, originally I was, when I left the ex-gay sort of scene and stopped going to the different programs and stopped, receiving the pastoral counseling and the reparative therapy counseling, I was really in a very confused, very lost place. And, a lot of people describe it as being in limbo. You know, you don't know how to move forward. You don't want to go back. You don't feel like you fit in anywhere, and you don't feel like you fit in with the gay community, and you know, it's just this really, really awful place. And so I had stayed there for a year or two, just sort of, you know, not knowing how to move forward, kind of journaling and being a part of it. It was really horrible. And I found out about Peterson's show, and through we were both involved in a website for gay Christians, even though at the time I wasn't sure that I identified as Christian and gay. I really didn't know, but I went to see his show, they're doing time in the Homo Nomo Halfway House. And that was in April of 2005, and I went to see his show, and it impacted me so strongly that I was actually kind of emotionally a little wreck for a while afterwards. I wrote an email, I think, the night or the next night after I'd seen the show, and said, wow, this really impacted me emotionally, and I'm not sure what to do with all of this. And so we kind of kept in touch a little bit, and then I, a few months later, it really prompted me to be able to look at everything and kind of unpack my own story, and And then I decided I wanted to start talking about my story like he was talking about his. And so I decided to tell my own story at a small women's group here in Denver. And so he graciously, you know, gave me his phone number and said, well, let's talk about it over the phone. And we did that. And, you know, one thing led to another, and we got, you know, became in, kept in contact. And then we kept talking about this stuff. And we would talk and talk. And one night we were having a conversation. It was just, you know, it was this frustration of there's all these people out there with these stories, but nobody's connecting. And there's all these ministries and groups out there that think they're doing this great job, but they're not hearing from the people who leave and walk away. You know, nobody's coming back to them and saying, look, hey, this didn't work for me. And so it was kind of that idea that sort of prompted all of this.
Well, do you think part of that pressure about no one's coming back saying this didn't work for me is because there is a feeling of guilt instilled that if it doesn't work for you, it's your fault?
Oh, absolutely. You leave just feeling, you know, like a failure, like you're broken. And if you do try to come back and say anything, you know, it's very difficult.
And often,
Peterson, you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And often you're shunned by the programs. When they find out that you're back in the lifestyle, you're off limits to a lot of people. So that, you know, you're really not part of that community anymore and you're not welcome.
So it feels a bit like their reaction to you is it's not my fault, and I suppose that must be part of it. It's not my fault. You could have done it if you wanted to. We really don't want to deal with you. You're wasting our time versus they wasted your time.
That's
no,
what it
it's
felt
a
like.
Lot. Go ahead, Pearson.
That's what it felt like. No, that's, you know, there are all kinds of different types of X-Day ministries, and some doors are open a little bit more than others, for sure. But typically they're only working with people who are considered success stories at that moment. And the people who move on, they don't really have any idea of what's really going on in their lives, and there's no relationship there. And why would you want to go back there anyway? Because often we're dismissed or we're told, well, you didn't try hard enough. So if you try this or you get back involved in this program, instead of them really validating that, hey, we have a mind, we have a spirituality, we thought through this stuff, maybe mm-hmm. we have something valid to say that could actually help you with the ministry that you're doing.
Well, Peterson and Christine also, judging from what I've read about you, you are both people of faith, as am I. I'm still very much involved in a Methodist church in the little town I live in, and becoming more involved in the Metropolitan Community Church in Tallahassee. Some people would ask you, how is it that you can hang on to any of your faith, considering the damage that has been done in the name of faith? How your faith is obviously very deep set, and you have some very very powerful core beliefs. How is it that you can hang on to it after being abused in this way?
Well, for me, one thing I think of is that I'm wired for God. That's just how I am. I don't know why I'm that way. I'm not better than other people. Some people just aren't. And for me to deny that spiritual side of me would be just as bad as when I denied the sexual part of me. It's just part of who I am. And for me to be authentic about who I am, I need to acknowledge that. Now, no question, the church has failed me over and over again, and individual Christians and ministers have failed me over and over again. But I don't let that translate into that God has failed me, because that's very different. And but I did make a choice to start attending a Quaker meeting, which looks and tastes and smells very differently from a normal church where you have pews and you have a minister. And it really respects that everyone brings something to the table. We sit in a circle. We sit in silence. We wait for someone to bring forth a message if they have one. And that's very powerful to me. I know a lot of people, after they've been through some of this, they can't even go into a queer-affirming church like the MCC because it brings back too many bad memories. You know, it's the same architecture. It's the same language often. And, you know, Jesus said that we need to put new wine in new wineskins, and I think sometimes we, you know, we don't use our creativity when it comes to our faith expression always in the queer community, and it's like we're recreating what we had in the old anti-gay world. It's like, no, doesn't have to look like that. That's not even biblical. It's just cultural. Let's make it look different. We could find God in all sorts of ways.
Well, Peterson, that's well said, and I like the way you have explained it as faith being a part of you, and it's something you can never get rid of, and people need to address that or at least respect it, along with your sexual orientation and the other aspects of your lives, and that you were able to separate what they did versus what your faith tells you, your personal faith, and I really respect that. Christine, how has it been for you regarding these issues of faith and spirituality after leaving the ex-gay, the gay reparative?
I still don't know how to talk about this. It's difficult for me to talk about this because it's not something that we kind of have words for. I don't know it's something I have words for where I'm at. We have words. We say somebody's a Christian or an atheist and I don't know where I fit in any of that really yet. And there's a lot of, it is hard for me to talk about it because I feel like I get sort of judged from a lot of different quarters about it. I feel like at this point I don't identify as a Christian. But it's not entirely, I get a lot of times I get people telling me that I've just, that they think it's incredibly sad that I've thrown out the baby with the bathwater. Which I find, frankly, somewhat insulting. a little bit. I understand what they're trying to say, that they think that, I've been so hurt by Christians and Christianity that I'm just, turning my back on the whole thing and walking the other way. But I also wish people would give me a little more credit than that, because I feel like in some ways I've been given a gift and that I've been forced to really examine what I believe, why I believe it, because I haven't been able to just sort of take everything that I was raised with and kind of run with it, because I've had to really stop and say, well, what does this mean for me, and gosh, it's so hard to explain. I'm sorry. I really still don't quite know how to talk about it.
Well, Christine, actually, you're doing an excellent job, and I'll tell you, I can share with you the way I parse it, at least, and in my personal life too. The word Christian has become almost meaningless in society, in as much as it's pretty much been sold. The word has been sold lock, stock, and barrel to the Republican Party and to the more hateful wing. Now, this, of course, we could argue that this is the fault of the media, because the media only brings up the Ann Coulters and the Jerry Falwells and the Dobsons, but never ever presents the alternate voices. But what I have said, and what I still say, and my listeners will not be the least bit surprised when I say this to you, is that I am no Christian. I love Jesus, but I am no Christian. And that is the way I've tried to balance this baby bathwater thing, at least in my life.
Right.
And another thing I should want to share with you is this drug recovery program. I can really empathize with both of you, because I have been through something like this too. As I said earlier, I spent a number of years of my life addicted to cocaine. And, of course, people who are addicted to cocaine get in trouble with the law, and, of course, I did too. After a couple of occurrences of that, I was sentenced by the court to attend a one-year in-house recovery program. Now, this recovery program is in Pensacola, and it's part of the Teen Challenge, units, which are located all over the country. And this is a very, very much charismatic, fundamentalist Christian program. And during the course of that, you know, we were hauled, we had in-house, you know, studies also, but we were hauled off to every fundamentalist church in Pensacola. Now, Pensacola, Florida is knee-deep in fundamentalist churches. Let me just clear that up right now. You cannot go a block without seeing some Holy Tabernacle on the billboard. It will say, "We believe in the King James Version only," and I'm not making this up. You can make it up. So, you know, throughout the year, I was constantly exposed to ministers from the pulpit who were beating up LGBT people and telling them they needed to, if you can't get your life straight, you need to be celibate, you know, things like that. I've heard so many gay, I know their sermons better than they do at this point in time. But through all of that, and this is Christine and you, Peterson, also referenced this, through all of that, I managed to take the good out of it. In fact, it did fix me, and it fixed the broken part of me that was addicted. And I have to, and so I have mixed feelings too. I give it the program credit for that. At the same time, though, I resent some things I was subjected to. This is a hard topic to talk about.
Yeah.
But I do admire.
I mean, at our conference, and it is a tricky. It's a tricky kind of landmine situation with ex-gay survivors, because you have people that are sort of on all, you know, just on, I mean, just completely all over the place with this issue. So even, you know, while planning our conference, we knew we would have people who didn't want to hear anything about God that, you know, like Peterson said, maybe it's just too triggering. And even for me, you know, I had, at one point, I went down to Colorado Springs and spent 6 hours having, you know, demons cast out of me. And, you know, this was the six-hour session. This isn't all the other little sessions with, you know, preachers and different things at different churches. And different
wow.
Churches. But this was
wow.
A six-hour intense one. You know, so I had quite a few of these really traumatic experiences in churches and things like that. So we knew there were people like that who just anything like that was going to kind of really re-traumatize them in some ways. But then you have people who have gone on to different spiritual paths altogether where it was not an issue of re-traumatizing. It was just an issue of they're on a different path and it's just not relevant, and it's perhaps disrespectful even in some ways to where they are. We want to honor where they are right now. You know, and then you have other people who have maintained the same Christian faith they had, and for them, that's a triumph for them that they were able to maintain that through everything they've gone through. You know, and so you have this wide audience, and how do you do this and basically respect where everybody's at? And be able to offer something for, you know, for everybody wherever they're at. So that is
interesting, Christine, how you say it that way. It almost makes me think of, like, we all come from this big dysfunctional family. And, you know, like, you have a bunch of siblings in a dysfunctional family. As you look back at your childhood, you know, you'll have some who will say, "Oh, my gosh, that was so horrible." And others who were saying, "Well, it wasn't so bad. I still hang out with Mom and Dad, and it's really cool." And it's like, depending on where we're at different points and how we're wired, those experiences will affect us differently, so that some can go back and enjoy the church the way it was, and others can say, "I can't, that's just this toxic. I can't even go near it. I have to express my spirituality some other way, even if it's in a Christian way, but not in that church, not that kind of a church."
Well, I know it's difficult for Christine. She mentioned the thing about going through an exorcism, and I know that's difficult to talk about. And we would likely, I'm sure the listeners would like to hear more about that, but I'm going to give you a minute to get that together and go to Peterson. And at Peterson, have you too been through this sort of treatment? You've been through the aversion therapy, I think. Tell us about some of the therapies you've been through.
Sure. I've been through a wide range of therapies and ministries, and it all started when I was a young teenage Christian, and it started with pastoral counseling, which is where a lot of people start. And my pastor tried to sort me out, and helped me by helping me to just talk about the issues. We prayed about it. He had me memorize scripture, hundreds of short scriptures and even whole chapters and books of the Bible, the belief being that there was evil working inside of me. If I took in the good word of God, it would replace the bad with the good. He always used that analogy of, like, you have two dogs, a white dog and a black dog, and they're going to fight each other. Which dog's going to win? And he said, the one you feed more, so feed your good dog, which, you know, has all these racial undertones, that the white dog was the good dog. It always turned out.
Agreed.
So it was that, praying, going to church as often as I can, as one of my characters in my play talks about it, which he emulates a lot of my own experience. His name is Marvin Bloom, and he talks about how he always goes to church, Sunday morning service, Sunday evening service, Tuesday night prayer meeting, Thursday night Bible study, Friday night praise and worship, step aerobic class. I mean, whatever it takes, I'm there. But when that didn't work, and I went off to Christian college and still struggled, that's when I found out about the ex-gay movement. And it was in the early 80s. AIDS was just exploding in New York. I was living right outside of New York City, and I got involved with a ministry called Life Ministry. And that's where I actually had my first exorcism at Life Ministry. And I was there, and they did a lot of testimonies. And a lot of their testimonies was, this is how awful the gay lifestyle was. I came to Jesus, and this is how my life is now. And at the time, people really were fleeing sex because it was terrifying, because there was all these fears around AIDS. So in some ways, this Life Ministry served as a little Noah's Ark, helping people be celibate for a time. But almost all of those people now are out and gay years later. But Life Ministries didn't help me either, and I got more counseling, and I actually went to Times Square Church, which is David Wilkerson's church, who started Teen Challenge. And I sat under his teaching for a number of years and had a lot of very specific lessons I got from ministers there about demons and how to fight the good fight. And, you know, so it was a lot about binding demons and praying. And sometimes I would pray in the morning before I left the house. I lived in New York City at this time. I would pray for 3 hours in the morning before I left. I'd get up at 4 in the morning so that I would be ready for warfare, because I saw it as warfare. And then I eventually got married to a woman because I thought, wow, I'm, you know, celibate. I'm not having sex with guys, although my fantasy life was a mess. And I got married to a woman, and in part, that was part of the ex-gay ministry too, thinking I can trust God that he's going to give me the grace to be a good husband and all's going to work out well, which sounds great, but sadly that's not how it happened. And typically that's not how it happened. Most people that I know who have been in mixed marriages like this with a former homosexual and a straight person, it almost always ends disastrously, as it did in my case. So there I was. I spent 15 years trying not to be gay and doing all this stuff, and then we even got reparative therapy counseling as a couple. And then finally, at that point, my marriage gone, I said, I'm going to take this really seriously. I'm going to stop everything. And I'm going to go to Memphis, Tennessee, and enroll in the Love in Action residential program. And I stayed there for 2 years and got their intensive therapy, which had to do with the 12-step programs. It had to do with, in part, how to become more masculine. There was all sorts of therapy sessions that we had and group therapy that we did. And part of it was just to literally dismantle your whole life in front of these people and share every single sexual encounter you have ever had in your life with every person, with every object, whatever it was, anything you did sexually, you had to write about it and talk about it. And the most devastating thing of all was they had us have family and friends weekend where our parents and our friends were invited to come, and we had to stand up and tell them, give an introduction like you do in AA or NA, but it was about the most shameful, embarrassing sexual encounter we had ever had. And you had to tell that in front of your mother and your father and all of these people. And they thought that by doing this, we were releasing our shame, when really it just increased it exponentially. And my parents left that weekend so broken and hurt and discouraged, and with the message that they had failed me, and that my life was a mess now because they were bad parents. And it came directly from some of the teachings that they got from the staff there.
Well, Peterson, I definitely want to get back to the parents thing, but But I want to go to Christine for just a second. Christine, I know the exorcism thing must have been traumatic, and if you'd rather not talk about it, I understand. The reason I bring it up again is people really need to hear an unvarnished, factual, straightforward description of just what goes on in those facilities. I'll explain our audience. We have a large number of heterosexual listeners who are progressive and interested and are learning much more about us because we represent real people only on this show. It's not like Hollywood movies, where nobody gets a clue. Are you willing to share with us what they did to you during those 6 hours?
Yeah, and, you know, I should say that, you know, it really is kind of a rare thing that people do exorcisms, and it's not something that the program I was in advocated or anything. This is actually something I kind of sought out on my own. And it's not like, in the movies, actually. You know, you mentioned Hollywood. And this wasn't actually like what you would see in the movies. It just so happened that there was a former missionary who had come to speak at my church, and she was very much into, sort of a, you know, Peterson had mentioned kind of a warfare kind of spirituality, sort of, you know, demons are very real, and, because of Jesus, we have power over them. And so I sought her out and, you know, and asked if I could see her privately. And so, you know, she got one other person with her, and I basically, went down to see her and, you know, and ended up having this, you know, what ended up being this basically an all-day, six-hour session of, you know, it was just a very intense, I mean, it is somewhat disappointing because it's not quite like the movie, actually, at all. But it was just very intense and very draining and very, you know, and it was kind of like almost what Peterson was saying. It was like I was just bringing up all these different things and, you know, talking about, you know, everything I had done and anything I thought might be a connection to where, you know, a demon or the devil had taken, you know, what we call taken a hold in my life. So everything from playing with an 8-ball to, you know, anything in my parents' past, my grandparents' past, anything like that. I mean, it was just, it's like, I mean, it sounds kind of weird, but I want to say it's like a witch hunt, sort of really.
Sounds that way to me, too.
Yeah, and, you know, and at the time I was actually seeing, this, I mean, again, this is like totally odd, and a lot of people's experiences aren't even like this. I just kind of had bizarre counselors or whatever. I had a counselor who actually thought that there were demons having sex with me at night. So they specifically would pray against that. like, you know, they would pray against, you know, and we command these demons out. I mean, this is very, you know, and I was, like, shaking all over. It's just very emotional. You know, you get whipped up into, like, a very emotional frenzy sort of state. And so there's kind of a lot of yelling and a kind of, you know. And I know Peterson has a little more about his experience, too. I don't know. Peterson, do you want to?
Yeah, I actually had three different exorcisms, one of them in an exodus
program. Oh, my. You're the motherload of exorcisms.
Professional.
But the thing is, you know, most of these escape programs would be appalled at the idea of an exorcism. So I don't want people to get the idea that, oh, they're all doing exorcisms, because that's dishonest. That's not how it happens. In fact, I almost wish they were all doing it, because people would flee and say, this is crazy. In fact, what they do, I think, is even harder, because you have people who are really nice and gentle and kind and talking to you very sweetly and trying to help you and coming up with these pseudo-psychological answers that almost make sense when they're mixed with Scripture, so that they sound like they have the authority of God and science. And that, I think, is actually ultimately more harmful for a lot of people than a one-time exorcism, although it's traumatic for sure. But people have been strung along in programs for years where they're giving this hope that there's hope still for you. And yes, you messed up, but we love you and we're going to keep working with you. That's when it really gets dangerous. And, you know, the exorcism, I actually bring it up in my play. Some of the stuff is so hot to handle. It's so painful that I needed to do this as a comedy. So I actually have a scene where I have this character talking about how the pastor cast out all these demons from him because he was having an internet porn addiction. And when he got home and he still was having problems with furryhotbuns.com, he said, well, you know, you may have downloaded a demonic internet virus, and you need to kill the demons out of your computer. And so, of course, he does, and the audience loves it. And it's funny, but it's also so tragic. And
hysterical and tragic, being the technical support person for the network regarding the computers. I really want to believe you. I honestly think there are demons in some, nonetheless. That's a terrific story. Please go ahead.
Well, and the character, he's, well, I can do a little of him if you like. He's a really great character.
Would love to. The 30-second clip that I have for playing at some point is just the very beginning where you talk about football helped, you know, that very beginning clip.
Well, this character, his name is Marvin, and he's very much based on me in a lot of ways, in his experience. I could do a little bit of Marvin.
Would love to hear it.
Addressing the audience, says, hello, everyone. My name is Marvin Bloom. How are you? I'm from Long Island, or as my pastor likes to call it, the Lord's Island, because we're going to save it for Jesus. And I'm a Christian, a very strong Christian, but I'm also Jewish. I was raised Jewish. I'm a Jew for Jesus. Jesus saved me from Judaism. Well, you know, the Judaism where they don't believe in judgment and hell, just good works, which what's that going to do for you? Anyway, I was having this terrible problem, and I know some of you have the same problem. It was with internet porn, and I didn't know what to do. So I went to pastor, and, you know, he said we need to do a deliverance. And I'll tell you, it took 2 hours. But and they, you know, it was lots of screaming, carrying on. But afterwards, I felt amazing. I mean, it was like they wiped me out inside. I was so clean. It was like a colonic for the soul. It was amazing.
While we're on this, I would like to share that it's a 33-second audio clip of Homo Nomo to give the listeners an idea of the range of Peterson Toscano. Bob, would you run the Homo Nomo clip, please? Okay, Bob may not have the clip available at this point. As soon as Bob confirms in chat with me that we have
live, and I even have a new character to add to it.
Well, sure, do it live. Who needs the audio clip? I'm just so used to doing clips.
You don't need clips. You got the real thing here. Come on.
Yeah, no, how silly of me.
I could do the opening scene of the Homo Nomo halfway house, and this is where the lead character, Chad, begins the tour, and he's assisted by another participant named Vlad. I like to rhyme. Okay, here we go. Hi, and welcome to the Homo Nomo Halfway House. My name is Chad, and I will be your tour guide. The Homo Nomo Halfway House is a Christian residential 12-step program that helps men, oh, and women too, we don't discriminate, overcome their homosexuality and compulsive sexual behavior. It's an amazing program, and I thank God they accepted me just in time. Now, before we begin our tour, I thought I should tell you a little bit about the rules and how it operates, and to assist me with that is our newest participant, Vlad. Hey, Vlad, we're ready for you. Vlad is from the former Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan or something. I never say it right. Anyway, it's so exciting what the Lord has done, how he's torn down all of those horrible iron curtains and those people who for years lived under such lies and oppression are now free, and they can come to our country and be part of a program like this one. Thank you, Jesus. So here's Vlad. So Vlad's going to tell you a little bit about the program, and I'll add my little running commentary. And don't be nervous, Vlad. They seem like a very friendly audience today, unlike last week when we were infiltrated by those P-flag people. They're so intolerant. Go ahead, Vlad.
Hello. My name is Vlad. I have been in this Homo Nomo halfway house for 27 days. Here in Homo Nomo Halfway House, we have 5 phases. We do 12 steps, and there are approximately 275 rules. First, I tell you about phase. When we move from phase to phase, this is called a phase bump, and technically, only the staff is allowed to bump you. Here in Homo Nomo Halfway House, you must shave every day, and this includes women, too.
That's right, Vlad. And when we shave, we're forbidden to use any aftershave or cologne. It's because of the sense memory of smell. You see, somebody could be wearing the scent of a former sexual partner, and that could trigger me just like that. So let me just say, for my personal safety and yours, could you please stay in the back of the tour if you're wearing Calvin Klein Obsession? Thanks.
Here in Homo Nomo Halfway House, you must report all FI behavior. FI stands for false image, because in our former lives, as practicing homosexuals, we often hid behind masks.
That's right, Vlad. We would plaster over our true God-given personalities with these false image masks. Oh, well, take me, for instance. Oh, my gosh. Before I came into this program, I was so effeminate. No, really, I was. And they have done wonders on me. And I think a lot of it has to do with the weekly football clinics. They really butched me up. And it goes on for 90 more minutes.
Priceless beyond all descriptions. Priceless. And the reviews that are comparing you to the early Whoopi Goldberg one-woman show are right on. It's hysterical from second to second, from moment to moment. It's just amazing. Did you perform this at the conference that just took place a few days ago?
Well, the conference actually was this summer. In June. A few days ago, I was actually in Denver with Christine, and we were just working on the website. But yes, I did. It was one of the opening events for the conference, because we, you know, one of our philosophies with the website and with the work that I do is that we need art to help us wrap our minds around some of this stuff. And, you know, because it's just, we've been so bombarded with words. So on the website, Christine is the curator of an online gallery, and we had an art show at the conference, and I did my play, and we really were hoping that through artistic means we could help people dislodge some places where they're stuck so they can begin to unpack their experiences. And
well,
Christine can give you a little bit of a timeline of how things went with the conference and how that all went, if you need that timeline.
I would love it. Yes, thank you, please.
Christine?
Go ahead, Christine.
Okay. So basically what happened is this: our website was sort of in the works for a little over a year. We were dreaming and planning and writing and, you know, kind of making connections with people and getting stories and, you know, getting people thinking about it. And it just so happened that we ended up being able to coincide the launch of the website with when the Glamour article about me came out. So that was April of this year. And at the same time, Peterson had been working for quite a long time with Soulforce and Jeff Lutz to start putting together this conference. And then I was able to come on board with that. And UCI, the University of California at Irvine, their LGBT center was able to come on as a third sponsor of the conference. And so they sponsored it, Soulforce sponsored it, Beyond X Gay sponsored it. And so we went full steam ahead planning this conference. And then that took place the end of June. And we had almost 200 people there. We had someone from England. We had somebody from Australia come. And then a week before the conference happened, the end of June, we were able to have the three former leaders come together and do the press conference where they issued the apology. And so that in LA, and that was actually a really huge moment. I need to talk about that for a minute, because you know, you kind of plan things and you talk about it, and you stop thinking of the emotional side of it. You know, you're just thinking, okay, then they're going to say this, and then, you know, whatever. And I wore a T-shirt. This is like a total random aside, but I'm just thrown in as a preview. I didn't think I was going to have anything really to do except behind the scenes stuff. So I had worn a T-shirt that day because I was half asleep. That said, think it's not illegal yet. Well, I ended up somehow being part of the press conference because we were going to accept symbolically the apology. And, you know, at a press conference, you don't want to wear any big controversial political thing.
No. You have to act absolutely newsworthy.
Right. So I had to keep throwing on the sweatshirt anytime I, you know, went in front of a camera. But it was amazing because we ended up getting all this coverage at CNN and documentary filmmakers. And, you know, so I'm thinking about all that stuff. And we went up there to accept the apology, and it was so emotional having these people who had really been instrumental in, you know, either the start of Exodus or, you know, moving it forward, being a part of the movement. And they're apologizing to me. You know, and they're emotional.
Wow.
And I, you know, I started crying. They're crying. We're hugging. Something
well,
got planned. You know, I thought, I'm going to step forward. I'm going to grab this. I'm going to be like, thanks. And, you know, we're crying. They're crying. I mean, it was just amazing. And so then, yeah, were you going to ask something? No? Yeah.
I'm
so
sorry.
Yeah?
I'm sorry. I missed the question. You asked me what I didn't hear.
Oh, I thought you were going to say something and I interrupted.
Oh, no, ma'am. No, ma'am. No,
okay.
No. I'm loving every word of it. Please
okay.
Continue.
So then we went into basically the conference a couple days later, which was, you know, at the UC Irvine campus. The LGBT Center provided everything for us. And Soulforce was really great putting everything together and, you know, just doing all the media that they're so great at doing. And, you know, they helped us get speakers. We had Reverend Mel White speaking. We just had A-list speakers all the way. And what, you know, the amazing thing about the conference, and actually I'd like Peterson to talk about this because he was really the person who from the start had a vision of what he wanted the conference to be and what he wanted it to be, how different he wanted it to be from existing conferences. So, Peterson?
Yeah, well, I'm a teacher by profession. I'm a high school teacher, and I've taken time off to do this work. And so I thought, well, what if we were to have this conference and did it in a way that people really learn and process information? And so often in the ex-gay world, it's just a matter of sitting down and having experts pour information into your head, and you're the broken, needy one coming to people for help. And I thought, that's not the right way we want to set this up. We all have a certain amount of knowledge to share with each other and healing to share with each other. So let's set it up so that people get to interact with each other. So the most important event, I think, of the whole weekend was when we did something called a chalk talk, which is what I learned when I was trained to be a facilitator for running groups with teachers. And what we did was we got a big piece of paper and we put it on a wall outside, and I gave them a prompt that said, ex-gay experiences, the harm / good. And I encouraged folks in silence to go up and just write a word, a phrase, or an image that prompt evoked for them. And I didn't know what we were going to get. You know, I didn't know if it was just going to be angry diatribes. It was what? But it was amazing because people allow themselves to be vulnerable, and they put out there on the paper about the depression, about the suicide, about the many conferences and the money they spent, but they also put out some of the good stuff they got out of the ex-gay experiences, and in a way reclaiming that so that it wasn't all a tragic loss for them. And in the end, I think most people are saying, well, it cost us much more harm than good, but it's nice to be able to get some of the good out of it. And if you see the video that we have posted, which you can get to on my blog, which you can get to through the Beyond ex-gay website, you will see a little bit of this chalk talk. And I know that was really helpful for a lot of people in the press that were there and covered it. They covered that in detail because it gave everyone a chance to share a little bit of their heart about their ex-gay experiences. Christine?
Yeah, so, you know, basically what we realized at the conference, like what Peterson was saying, is this wasn't a sit-down, shut-up-and-listen conference. This was participation. This was learning. This was, you know, for most of us, we spent almost all our time being talked to, told what we should think, what we should be doing. And so we just wanted this to be a very different kind of conference. And it was, and it was an amazing conference and life-changing for so many people, I think. I mean, for
lots of good connections, too. People made a lot of connections that they're following up, and people have started blogging now and doing their own video blogs about their ex-gay experiences.
And people were able to share their stories on videos for the first time. A couple of people started blogging. And then right after that, we followed up with what we called the Survivors Initiative, which we started going to different places, like Peterson mentioned, across the country, and having two or three people tell their stories at different key locations and presenting frame collages to the people at those locations, which we started out with NARS on Monday and went to other locations. We went to New Life Church here in Colorado Springs, which was formerly Ted Haggard's church. We went to Southern Baptist headquarters in Nashville. We had a Mormon couple who the husband was gay, the wife is straight. They've been married 25 years, and they went to Salt Lake City to do a press conference. Talk about guts. So, it's just been a lot of momentum after that. And then we had three Australian former ex-gay leaders who added their names to the apology as well. And, it's just followed. It's just followed one thing after another.
Christine, this...
Peterson?
What's that?
Christine? I was just asking Peterson if I'd leave anything out.
Yeah, that was really, the Australians coming forward and adding their name to the apology. That was really huge, too, because these were three former leaders, ex-gay leaders from Australia. And the site, the Beyond ex-gay website, has gotten tens of thousands of visitors, and we've gotten a lot of emails from people who are beginning to tell their stories. And as a result of the conference, it's like over 30 people now who have told their stories that they were never told before, and it just keeps growing. And that's what's so exciting, because up until now, other people have been telling our stories. Either ex-gays have been saying what the failures look like and what kind of lives we're leading, or even ex-gay activists who mean well sort of misrepresent our stories in trying to have a political debate about the ex-gay movement. But this is the first time that ex-gay survivors have really come forward to talk about what our experience was. And I think what it does is it changes even the way the media covers the story, so that it's not so much like these people say you can change and these people say you can't. Rather, here's a story of someone who desperately tried to change something in their life and it almost destroyed them. Let's look at that story. And I think that's the story that America needs to hear, because it's not the one that's been told up until now.
Well, Peterson, you mentioned the Australian folks. I recall now that part of the audio that we played in the past when talking about this were definitely clips from the folks from Australia. Those were very powerful testimonies. And you mentioned the number of people that are involved now. There was something I wanted to say to you at some point during the evening, and now is just time as any. You may think I'm nuts for wanting to do this, but if you would put the word out among all of the people that are listed on your site and all of the people who participate, if any of those people would be willing to come on this show and tell their stories. Now, you could explain to them they don't have to remain the entire 2 hours. They can do 15 minutes if that's what they... But I would love to hear more of these stories. I think it's so important that we get this out, because it's just so cruel what's happening. It seems that the ministries are preying on the psychological situations that LGBT folks are going through and making a huge profit, and somebody has got to get these stories out, and I want to be part of it. If you would at some point send it, just tell them, drop me an email to peter@headonradionetwork.com, and I will absolutely guarantee you I'll set every one of them up. I'm firmly behind this.
Totally.
I was about to branch to a different subject. Please continue.
And what we find is that in telling our stories, it's great because it's a witness and it's a warning, but it's also part of our own healing, because in telling our stories, we can work through what we were doing to ourselves. And so there is a healing power in telling our stories. And on the website Beyond Ex-Gay, under the articles, I just posted an article called Ex-Gay Harm, What Does It Mean to You?, where I talk about the 9 different categories of harm where people have experienced harm. So it's emotional, psychological, spiritual, relationship harm, financial, career, physical harm, sexual harm, and developmental harm. And, you know, when you start talking about it, you realize, wow, this wasn't even just about religion. There was so much more going on for me than that.
Well,
you had something you wanted to go to now.
Oh, well, yeah, I was just going to point out to you, I didn't want to miss telling you that the chat room was in absolute hysteria when you went through the segment, and I just wanted to share with you that went over beautifully. Everybody loved it, and I'm wondering if there is a DVD available of any of your performances, and if so, how do we get that? I would love to see it.
Well, I'm actually retiring the Homo Nomo Halfway House company.
No.
I am, because it will be 5 years. I premiered it on my 38th birthday, in Memphis in 2003. And so I'm going to retire it because it will be 5 years, and I don't want to be the Homo Nomo guy for the rest of my life.
Sure.
Part of the conference for me was, in a way, you know, after 10 years of detoxing from this, I really feel like I've purged my system of my ex-gay past. So when I go to Memphis in February, I'm going to do one of my final performances there, and we're going to film it, and there will be a DVD available. I also have an audio CD soon of my character Marvin and some of his audio blogs that he used to do, telling his crazy stories of exorcisms and his review of Brokeback Mountain and how he tried to
save from
anonymous sexual encounters in bathrooms and all sorts of wonderful things like that.
That will all be available. Perfect. This is just the sort of thing that we love to run as little segments of the show. Christine, and it will be used, I assure you. Christine, back to you. Now,
I'm sorry,
Peterson,
I don't
mentioned
characters at all. So sad. It's like a disappointment. I only do art. I don't know what to tell you.
Well, Peterson mentioned having gone through football therapy, so to speak. I understand that they ran lesbians through Mary Kay Beauty makeup. Did that happen to you? Did they make you sit down with Mary Kay and do all that?
No. And that's another one of those things where that so rarely happens. I mean, you know, the truth of it is that some of those stereotypes, some of those things that, you know, but I'm a cheerleader, really don't happen. I mean, 99% of the time, they really don't happen. So as much fun as they are to, you know, to joke about, it's pretty rare. But many of us do that kind of stuff kind of on our own. Like, nobody prompted me to do that sort of thing, and I don't have any kind of affinity towards Mary Kay. But what happened was, I sort of wanted to become, you know, sort of become more feminine. I felt like that was a part of my healing that I needed to do when I was here, when I moved here to Denver. Because part of, you know, what happened for me is that I decided, part of my story is that I decided that I needed to move out of California. And so, for one thing, there wasn't anything really close by to me that had anything specifically for women. And because the SK movement is pretty much a kind of a white male sort of movement.
We're the other overprocessed white meat.
Peterson, it seems to me they should have used the gay guys to do the Mary Kay thing on the lesbian. Sorry. Another thing I was wondering about, Christine, is you spent about 4 years in the program. Peterson was trapped into it almost 20 years. What is the general range that happens to people, or is it just all over the map about getting out of it? You seem to, now 4 years is a long time. I'm not minimizing it. It's a very long time.
Noticing how swift I am, right? Peterson's not saying anything now. He's like,
So you just got fed up with it fairly quickly,
Is that the idea, or do you feel you had less guilt, or?
I'm just curious. In a big rush, basically.
I see.
She's smarter
part of it,
than
I think.
Am.
I was, smarter than Peterson, right? Part of it, I think, I was older when I started doing it. So I started when I was 27. And I think I started to do everything in kind of a mad rush. So I threw myself into it. I mean, I moved 4 states away. I quit a job, very good pay, and started working at an hourly wage at a truck parts place. I had a professional salary job in California as a graphic designer and, started working at a truck parts place here in Colorado. Lived in somebody's basement, lived in a pastor's basement. So I don't know if that's part of it, but I just threw myself into it. And I had read, part of, me going into it was that I had read all of these things, but there was, if you've been abused, or if you didn't have a good relationship with your same-sex parent, or if you had this, if you were tormented by your peers, on and on and on, all these things, these were all, reasons that you were probably gay. And so, I'm reading this list, I'm going, oh, there's some of these things that fit. So, I was very excited, like, wow, I, have a good chance of getting cured here. So I, came out here and just threw myself into it. And so maybe that's why I got sort of, I worked my way through a lot of it sort of more quickly. I'm not sure. What do you think, Peterson?
Well, yeah, I think, I think you make a good point about starting older. And I think if I had started older, it probably would have been different for me, too. I think also part of it is just personality. I think you're more pragmatic than I am in a lot of ways. And I think you're, I was, filled with hopes and dreams. And, and the ex-gay movement, you make a good point too, Christine, when you say it's a white male movement. In a way, there was a lot more pressure for me to change in society, particularly in the evangelical church, because men are considered more valuable in the evangelical church, and female sexuality is not considered such a threat, because the thought is, well, if there's no penis, what's really going to happen? And so they totally devalue female sexuality anyway. And if you look at it, the church, the evangelical church, already is an ex-lesbian movement. I mean, they're teaching you how to submit to your husband, how to be in a proper gender role. There's not much
excellent
more you can get at an ex-gay program except learning about enmeshed relationships, which is a big thing that they get on the women about. But the ex-gay movement really is a white evangelical male movement. And I think it's because this is not just about religion, it's about power and privilege in America. And if you're a white male evangelical in America, you have a lot of power and privilege. But if you're not straight, or if you're a feminized man, well, you feel the sudden loss of cabin pressure of power and privilege in the church, and suddenly you can't be on that committee, you can't say the prayer, you can't go on the mission trip. So you will scramble, and other people will scramble with you to get you back to that place so that you can be a proper male in the church. So it's interesting, because lots of times people ask me, oh, can you, lead us to a lesbian ex-gay survivor? And it's not that they're not out there, but really this has been a move to save men. It's a male movement in a lot of ways. Not exclusively, but that's where a lot of the resources go.
Interesting.
And I can vouch for that.
Question that's coming from production chat. Do either of you see any connection between this ex-gay movement and things like abstinence-only education? In other words, does it seem to be just a big denial of human sexuality?
Well, it seems like there's a lot of ignorance when it comes to sexuality. And this goes back to, church teaching, back to Augustine, when we started separating the flesh and the spirit and thinking that anything physical is evil and bad. And then, of course, in the United States and America, we have all these puritanical ideas about sexuality. And so, some of it is very connected, and forgetting that we are sexual beings. That doesn't mean that we have to have sex 24 hours a day, but that when we suppress our sexuality, and it does create problems. again, you can be celibate without suppressing your sexuality because you're still acknowledging you're a sexual being, and you can be celibate for healthy reasons, not always for unhealthy reasons. But if you think that there's something wrong and evil and perverse and deformed about your sexuality and you try to lop it off, you're going to end up lopping off a whole part of yourself, and that's only going to bring you a world of woe.
And what's interesting about that, too, is that many times what happens with ex-gay folk, or at least, you know, the ones I know, and what happened with me, is that you go through a period of time after the first year of real, you know, year or two maybe, or whatever your first period of time is, of real struggle, where suddenly you feel like something's changing. And it's this amazing thing, and suddenly you're like, oh my gosh, I'm changing. This is amazing. This is amazing. What it really is, and, you know, I've talked to some people about this, and this is definitely the case for me, what it really is that you're sort of not attracted to anything, because what I did is I walled off my sexuality. Now, inadvertently, I also walled off my creativity. I walled off a lot of other things about me that I didn't realize. But I shut so much of that down. So I was excited because I wasn't, you know, feeling arousal towards women, but I didn't realize I kind of wasn't feeling that towards anything or anyone. So it feels like success because that's not really being addressed in, you know, within the ex-gay circles. They're not saying, you know, watch out because maybe what's happening is you're not feeling anything sexually. But that's, you know, you get all kinds of praise, like, oh, praise the Lord, that's so great, you know, you're less temptation, you're really, you know, you're kind of winning the battle, and praise the Lord. And but because there isn't sort of this acknowledgement right up front about what human sexuality really is, then they're not also acknowledging that a lot of this is, you know, is really just a suppression of that. And I feel like that's what happened to me, was that you know, I really just shut everything down. And then at some point, you know, something broke through all of that. And then I was having these attractions back, and it was like, oh, no, it didn't work, you know. And so I think there's a lot to be said for that. And I think that's part of what happens to people when they talk about, you know, if you really, sometimes you really corner people and try to get them to answer questions about what their sexuality really is like, when they say, well, they're not as attracted to men, you know, for men, they're not as attracted to men anymore, and you kind of push, well, are you attracted to women? Are you attracted? Well, no. You know, then what's happened? What is that?
Well, I understand about being boxed into a corner. And the browbeating and peer pressure. I have a short story with you. Somewhat related to the time that I was, the judge sentenced me to the year in, which I refer to as the year of being held captive by the Holy Rollers at the Pentecostal. The attorney that I had came highly recommended. He was a very good attorney. However, he was a fundamentalist evangelical type. And I remember, you know, in the little attorney room, you know, when you're in jail, you go to the little attorney room and you meet with your attorney through a glass window, and it's like, you know, only you and the... And before he would accept my case, and I still... You know, before he would accept my case, I had to pray with him that the demon of homosexuality would leave, you know? It was the first time in my life I ever... You know, I needed the freaking attorney, right? He was a good attorney. He had the connections. And I thought to myself, Lord, forgive me. I'm going to cross my fingers and pray with this jackass. And which I did. But, you know, it's the whole thing about the pressure, it's really something awful. Peterson, you mentioned parents earlier, and the guilt trips that are put on parents. You mentioned a very disturbing scene where the parents were brought in, and you had to tell them, which is nobody's business, you know, any sort of sexual activity that you had in the past. And what did they do to the parents? Did they beat up the parents more over people that are resisting or not proceeding in the way they are, or do they cut slack to the folks that are, you know, just, you know, say yes at all the right places?
Well, you have to understand that there is a pretty well widely accepted philosophy or theory among ex-gay theorists. So these are the promoters and providers of ex-gay ministries. Not exclusively, but pretty much all of them will say that you get a gay boy because you've got an overbearing mom and a emotionally or physically absent dad. There might be other things thrown in there, like some, you know, gender role confusion, maybe a little sexual abuse, but that formula is what opens the door to make a gay kid, to make a gay boy. And this is repeated over and over again. It's in books, it's been at seminars, the Love One Out conferences that Focus on the Family puts on. This gets put out there, and parents who are traditionally pretty insecure about their parenting to begin with, they hear this, and they immediately, so many of them grab it and say, we did something wrong. And, you know, some of this stuff, I think of it as like the description of somebody's, you know, horoscope, where, you know, like the, you know, your zodiac, where it's like, oh, let me read what Capricorn is. And you're like, okay, so you're a really friendly person, but sometimes you can be very private. You're very ambitious, but you can be lazy. You're like, oh, my gosh, that's just so me. And you're like, oh, wait, that's Taurus. Oh, wait, that was the wrong one. And they put out this teaching that's in such a general way that it could almost fit any family, you know, if you really think about it. Because if you even say, well, you know, my dad was always there for us. And they're like, well, always? Was there ever a time he wasn't? And you say, well, there was that time he was away for 2 weeks on that business trip. That's it. It was that critical moment of your development. And that, and of course, you're looking for answers. And the parents are looking for answers. And they walk away with the idea that they screwed up. And then what happens is the kid who's really angry about being gay suddenly has a scapegoat. And it creates tension between parents and children. And I've spoken with ex-gay survivors who today have a horrible relationship with their parents because of some of this therapy. And the parents are saying, oh, it was our fault, and we're so sorry, and we're going to do stuff. And the kid's like, no, it's not, or yes, it is. And it creates division. You know, the very thing that a ministry is supposed to do, is supposed to bring life, is to build relationships, and it tears it down.
Can I interject?
And I'm so fortunate that my parents were the kind of parents, they just wanted to love me. They never wanted me to go into an ex-gay program, but they wouldn't stop me because it's what I wanted. And when I finally came out to my parents and said, I'm done with this, my mom's response was, well, it's about time. But my father, New York Bronx guy, he's always got something funny to say. He says, well, you know, it's all right, son. You did your best, but besides, you can't make a fish fly. I'm like, well, yeah, you can't make a fish fly. Now, you can chuck a fish across the room, and it thinks it's flying, which I did for 17 years, but eventually it smashes its head against the wall. But fortunately for me, I had parents there who just loved me, and they didn't care about my sexual orientation. But sadly, there are far too many people out there who become homeless in regards to parents who will not receive them and love them for who they are. And, you know, it's so crazy. It's like, this is your child. This is your offspring. And people get so brainwashed into thinking that their child has to be a certain way in order for them to be acceptable. That's conditional love. And that's contrary to anything I see anywhere in the scriptures.
Very good point. You were about to say something, Christine?
Yeah, you know, when Peter Stowe was talking about earlier, our Chuck talk that we did, where we had this paper that everybody was free to write on, a couple of the more moving comments that people had written. One person wrote, my parents felt like failures. Another person wrote, blaming my parents, I legally changed my name.
Wow.
Another person wrote, my dad didn't make me gay, he made me real. I love you, Dad. Rest in peace. And, you know, those are the kind of comments on there. That's the kind of harm that could come to families. I mean, not only the person that you know, is having the ex-gay therapy, but the families as well. And I actually did a conference, and somebody said, when I finished doing all of this reparative therapy, And when I realized, you know, none of it worked, that's when I had to go home and try to repair everything within my family. You know, and I thought, wow, that's when the real reparative therapy work began. Yeah, yeah, because
yeah,
everything had gotten torn apart with people thinking, oh, well, you're accusing me of not being a good mom, or what did I do wrong? And, you know, so everything was a mess after he had gone through that. And
seems to me that so much of what we deal with in today's society, there's this whole day after day fear, fear, fear. You know, we're going to have somebody blow up a Sears building, the fear of a train, you know, being hijacked by, you know, and run into a, you know, by somebody from Iran, you know. And then it's fear, and that's coupled closely with guilt, which seems to be what they're doing here. They're preying on the guilt of the parent, which really shouldn't be there to begin with, but nonetheless they prey on it because it is, and they prey on the person who is attending the series. They prey on their guilt. It seems to be all about that particular connection, and a huge amount of damage can be done.
Well, and, you know, and really the saddest part is that I'll honestly tell you, and I know a lot of people who are escape providers, promoters, whatever, is many of them sincerely feel like they're doing the right thing. A lot of them are not making money at this, especially people sort of at the local level who are just working out of their churches. They're not making money at this. They're not making a lot of money. They really feel like they're doing the right thing. They feel like they're helping people. And to me, I mean, that's sad too. You know, is that these are people that really, really do not intend to harm people. And part of, I feel like that's part of why we also need to be talking about this as well and appeal to that part of them that does want to do good for people and not harm them.
I see.
And
I see where you're
sitting. That's kind of controversial sometimes to say.
But I can understand. Yeah, go ahead, Peterson, please.
And some of these people, you know, they're ex-gay themselves. They're people who desperately want this to work for themselves, too. And they can't afford to see too many failures. And that's, I think in part that's why they keep some of the failures so far away, and they just surround themselves with successes because they want to not be gay. And they have something at stake. And they're victims of the same system that says that if you're not, you know, if you're gay, well, then you're going to lose your family. You're going to lose your job. You're going to lose your church. You're going to lose everything that's precious to you. So they're fighting with all their hearts, many of these folks, to make this work for them because they believe this is the way that it has to be for them, not just because the Bible says so, but because so much of what they hold precious is tied to it. And if they fail, they have to start from scratch, and that's huge.
Yeah, and, you know, I was going to say your question about I only did this 4 years and Peterson, you know, 17. Part of it, I didn't have a marriage. I didn't have the same kinds of things invested, I don't think. And when I, because of the advertising and the things that drew me into it, when there became sort of these public failures and John Polk situation, where he was caught in a gay bar, after having, you know, been on TV and, you know, he had changed and all of this stuff, I think I had a lot more sort of really public kind of stuff in my face, so cut Peterson some slack with that.
Peterson brought up the term keeping the ones who don't succeed, I believe is the way he put it, away, and the ones who do succeed, you know, close as poster children. So question to both of you, what in the name of everything holy does succeed mean? In this.
Great question. Christine, do you want to take that? You want me to start?
No, you're still free.
It's a great question. You know, I just was looking online. There was some news program in North Carolina that had a breaking news story that their breaking news story, I guess it was a slow news day, was something like pastor says that he is no longer gay or God saved him from homosexuality. And this is a news story on the regular 5 o'clock news. Minister says God changed him from gay to straight. It's out of North Carolina. And, you know, what that minister is not saying is that he probably still has same-sex attraction. All right? He, you know, he may even struggle with porn. I don't know that for a fact, but he may. You know, there's all sorts of things that when these people, and when I did it myself, I stood up and I said, God delivered me from homosexuality, because I gave my testimony many times that way. People heard that I was no longer gay and that I was a heterosexual. But what I was really saying was, I no longer identified as gay, and I didn't want to have gay sex. And even though I stumbled every now and then, my identity was in Christ, and I was really believing that one day I would be completely celibate and my mind would be free of these fantasies of other men. And so there's a lot of dishonesty that happens of what's said and what's not said. So success for a lot of people means celibacy, really, when they have same-sex desires and they're celibate and that they have totally dug themselves out of any sort of gay identity. So they have no gay friends, they don't watch any gay-themed television programs, go to gay venues, etc. You know, for other people, you know, the real success, though, is when they show people who are married with children almost as accessories. Like, hey, here they are. And there was the one ex-gay program I went to, they had like this wall of fame of all of the marriages that took place through the ministry. And you got the message right away that if you wanted to be a really successful ex-gay, you need to be partnered heterosexually, which is unbelievably cruel to the spouse who is dragged into such a marriage. And sometimes I guess they work, you know, because some people could make it work for all kinds of reasons, but the vast majority do not. And at BeyondXGay.com, we have among our narratives of some wives who were married to men who were ex-gay, and the devastating harm that it brought them in the marriage when, you know, they couldn't figure out what was going on with their husband who didn't want to be with them. And the pain of being with someone who doesn't find you sexually attractive, and you're basically in large part there to try to save him. You know, it's more complicated than that. These relationships were very full in a lot of ways, but they're also survivors as well, these spouses. So success, what is the success? It's usually not what it appears to be on the billboards. When they say, I question homosexuality, change is possible, I think it's more honest to say 2 tens for a 20 is the kind of change that is completely possible, but change in orientation is not.
Really what it boils down to is that, you know, when people say change is possible, you know, change in behavior is entirely possible. Orientation, that's a whole different, you know, that's a whole different thing. And so that's the problem, is that, you know, if you can say, yeah, change is totally possible, and you get a whole group, you know, you stand up in church, you say, I changed, and you get a whole group of church people who walk out thinking change in orientation, when the person is just talking about change of behavior.
Right.
You know, and that's the biggest problem, is that nobody's differentiating. You know, and it's hard because it is deceptive. I mean, I feel like most people know that most people are going to think they mean they've really changed and that they never fantasize about the same sex or anything like that. But the reality is, anybody in an ex-gay program, anybody who's, you know, has their weekly meetings with other ex-gays, knows that they're all, you know, that they're talking about their struggles and when they fall. And you know, but it's, I mean, that's the sticking point, is the behavior versus the orientation. And I did the same thing as Peterson. I once, you know, spoke at a group and said, you know, I'm being set free from homosexuality. And I truly believe that. And I didn't believe I was lying, because I absolutely believe, you know, Jesus is doing this work. And I'm speaking in faith, and, you know, I'm not lying. This is what's happening.
I completely get that.
For me, it was, you know, so.
I completely get it in the sense that you were a work in progress.
Right.
I understand completely. My take on this is, and people have asked me to explain it, I have used the terms that, you know, do I believe that God could make my brown eyes blue? Well, yes. But do I believe that if I sat and prayed from here to eternity for God to do that, I don't think it would ever happen. Why, in the name of anything logical, would he do that? I'm, you know, potter clay. bit. Why? Why would it? Just my small take on it. I want to ask you both about sexual abuse. So many times we read in these brochures/websites from these ministries, and by the way, they are legion. There are links to delivery ministries, Exodus International, the National Association of Therapy, the John 836 group, Christ-Centered Counseling. The list goes on and on and on. All of these are about reforming us, and so many of these people say that the reason that folks are gay is because we were sexually abused. And I'm getting the impression from reading some of your information, Christine and Peterson, that in fact they are maybe saying that because a lot of people who are sexually abused are attracted to the programs because they have so many negative feelings about being sexually, self-worth issues. Now, mind you, I'm not asking either one of you if you're sexually abused, but do you find in a large part that sexually abused people are attracted to the programs? When they're children?
It's a great point, and I think you really capture some of it very well. Over at Beyond Ex-Gay, I have an article about that called How Sexual Abuse Made Me Ex-Gay. And I was sexually abused as a child, and I was told right from the get-go from anyone I talked to, well, that's why you're gay. And it could be that's when your sexuality got tampered with, that's when the demons entered. There were all sorts of philosophies of what happened, but that was the moment that something happened. And I know studies have been done on this, but it seems like the vast majority of people I have met in ex-gay programs had some sort of sexual abuse in their past. Not all of them, by any stretch of the imagination, but many, many. And I do believe that for many people who have unresolved sexual abuse in their past, where they've never really acknowledged it as abuse, where they're filled with the shame of that abuse, and the guilt, they have shame and guilt because they're carrying somebody else's shame and guilt that was pressed on them. And so when they hear people saying, God can set you free, you are sexually broken, and we can help you find freedom and cleansing, well, for someone who feels that load of shame and guilt from somebody else's abuse, well, that sounds unbelievably inviting because you feel like a dirty, nasty thing. So you go, and you go with all of these feelings, and they promise you freedom. And I heard Joe Court, he's a gay psychologist, and he said, it's a form of sexual abuse, these ex-gay programs. It's a more passive form of abuse, but you have somebody in power imposing their sexuality on someone who has less power, which is very much how abuse works.
Well said.
Someone has been abused and it hasn't been dealt with, it's very possible that they can be open up for more abuse. They're vulnerable. And I think the wording in these programs, they need to take responsibility because they're preying on people who have been abused and they're not addressing the abuse issues in an appropriate way and they're deepening the abuse.
It sounds like it's an evil thing, it really, because by not what you're doing to them, I'm hearing you say, is not only are you not going to fix them, you don't even address the core problem of abuse. Is that what's happening?
Right, and for 17 years, no one addressed the core problem of abuse until the very, very end of my time at Love and Action. I was with an outside counselor that they had contracted, and the one day we were talking, and I was struggling to talk about the abuse, and he was trying to help me to see it. And he said something that revolutionized my world. He said, Peterson, there's a difference between being gay and being abused. And in 17 years of looking for help, it was the first time I heard something like that. And he separated the two issues for me in such a way that it freed me up from some of the angst that I had about the abuse so I can see them as separate issues. And it was very shortly after that, just a few months, that I came to the place where I accepted that I was gay and that I couldn't fix that and that it wasn't something that I needed to fix.
I'm so glad that happened. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add that actually for some people, one of the good things for them that comes out of, that can come out of the ex-gay movement is they do get some help for some of those issues because of part of the psychological model of what may have caused you to be gay. Some people do get some help for those issues, you know, as sort of a result of that. So that can be a good thing for some people, but unfortunately, it comes with so much other baggage. And so sometimes some of it is addressed, but then so much else gets heaped on with it that it's really, it's one of those mixed sort of things where people say, well, it's kind of a good thing, but then, you know, all this other stuff got attached onto it. Now I kind of need more therapy to deal with that with everything else in it. The other really unfortunate thing about it is that these ex-gay counselors and you know, people who are running these programs, to them, what they're seeing, this is the gay community to them. This is, like, all they're seeing is the gay community, is the people who are coming to them, who, you know, it's this really out-of-proportion view of the, you know, so then they'll come back and say, well, 90% of the gay community has been sexually abused. And to them, that's just reality. You know, so then they go out there with these statistics, and then that's where, you know, kind of all, you know, that's where they get those numbers, and they think that's just reality because that's what they're seeing. And, you know, it really blew my mind once I left the whole ex-gay thing and I started meeting other people, and it weren't all these people who'd been abused. Like, oh, my gosh, how did this happen, you know? And it was just being in totally different circles and meeting totally different people and realizing, wow, there is a whole completely different set of people that go to the ex-gay ministries. And I feel like, you know, many of us are drawn there because we do have these unsolved issues.
It's amazing and complex. And here again, this brings in the whole thing of how parents react. If a person was abused by a parent, then the whole guilt trip for the parent, I can see where this could really damage a family unit even further than it was already dysfunctional by doing this all, because each one feels, the child feels perhaps resentment and lack of self-worth, the parent feels guilt, you all feel guilt. It just seems so remarkably complicated. It would require a top-notch psychologist to work through all of it.
Well, and the problem is these are not top-notch psychologists. Most of the people running these programs have limited training. When I was going to the Love and Action program, as far as I know, the director of the program, the highest degree he held was a high school diploma. He never took Psych 101. He never, you know, the only theology class he had was through his church. And he's handling these incredibly complicated issues and not having the basic training. And another thing, along with the sexual addiction, another group of people who often end up in ex-gay programs are people who are struggling with sexual addiction. They're sexually abused, and then people with sexual addiction. Sometimes they go hand in hand, but often they flee to ex-gay programs looking for help because, sadly, in the LGBT community, there isn't always the help needed to help people who are dealing with sexual addiction issues and even with sexual abuse. And one thing I often say to my audiences during the Q&A is that if we did a better job in our community taking care of our own, we would drive these places out of business. And they exist in part because there is still a vacuum within our communities. Our communities, the LGBT communities, are not always faith-friendly. I find it harder sometimes to come out as a Christian among queer folks than to come out gay among church folks. And there also, we don't have the services and the support needed for people who are struggling with sexual addiction and with sexual abuse. Unless they've got money for a counselor, they really have a hard time. And many of these ministries are offering help for free. And, you know, and so I think it's something that we need to look at. It's so easy to point our fingers at these programs and say, this is bad that they're doing that. But I think it's a good question to ask, what can we do better in our own communities so that we have the services and the support so that people won't run to these kind of places?
Well, good point. I'm wondering if there are support groups for parents who have been through this. We have this
the ex-gay and the services that you're offering, is there something like a Parents of Ex-Gay that would be something the equivalent like a PFLAG?
Well, I know that PFLAG is very concerned with this, and I've been talking to PFLAG people, and I think PFLAG would be the appropriate place for something like this to take place. But there isn't, at this point, a support group for parents. The ex-gays actually have a support group. They have a group called PFOX, Parents and Friends of Ex-Gays. Not a particularly creative name, if you ask me. But,
I agree.
They've got something there. But, yeah, I think it would be really helpful. A lot of parents have been hurt, and we're hoping if any parent is listening who has been through some sort of ex-gay therapy with their child, I would love them to contact us through beyondxgay.com, as well as any ex-gay survivor. Do that through our website, because we want to highlight your stories. And parents, I think, need to hear that they're not to blame for their kids being gay. And there needs to be some real help there for the parents.
Well, you know that the... It's a 2-hour show, but obviously we could run a 4-hour show on this. There's so much to cover. Question to both of you: how about people, Mormons, Jews? Do they come to the ex-gay therapy centers? And in addition to being discouraged from being a lesbian or a gay person, or they also try to talk them out of their faith and work them into being a Christian? Is there that level of it too?
Well, most of the programs are evangelical Christian programs. Now, the Mormons do have a program. There is a Jewish program. There's a Catholic program. There are some secular programs, but they're really small. Most of the programs are evangelical Christian. And one of the first steps, though, of recovery in these programs is you have to be born again. So, for instance, even in the program I was at, there was a guy who was a Christian, but he went to a church that met on Saturdays, like the Seventh-day Adventists. And they said, if you're going to be part of this program, you have to worship like the rest of us on Sundays, and you have to conform to this evangelical model that we have. So, yeah, and I often think about this. In the United States, conversion, when we convert to evangelical Christianity, it's not just a spiritual conversion, it's a cultural conversion. And the ex-gay movement is very much in keeping with that cultural conversion.
Okay. I also need to get this question in to the both of you. Do you remember a while back there was a kid, he was under the legal age, but he ran a website that he sort of snuck it in as a blog. He was secretly blogging from within one of these institutions. He was being held against his will. I don't recall his name. What became of him? Do you guys know him?
Well, Christine and I are actually chatting online as we're doing this interview. She's like, "You got this one," because I know very much the story. This took place at Love in Action, a program they had called Refuge 2 years ago in the summer of 2005. And a young man by the name of Zach Stark, 16 years old, after coming out to his parents, they forced him to attend Love in Action. But before he went in, he sent out a bulletin on MySpace and put up a couple of blog entries with all of the rules of the program. And his friends heard about it, and they were horrified, and they forwarded it all to their friends. And a group of young people, pretty much all under the age of 21, began this protest. And every morning and every night when Zach was dropped off and picked up, they were there with signs saying, "It's okay to be gay, and God loves fags." And CNN got involved, the New York Times, the state of Tennessee investigated, and a lot of pressure was on the program. And the kid went through the program. I believe he was there for almost 8 weeks of the program, and he came out of it. He's 18 now, and he is still under his parents' control, and it's his story. So I don't want to talk about his story. And I'm sure when he's ready, he will come forward. But the problem is with a lot of these kids, even if they're of age, if they don't always toe the line, the parents will make it so that they won't pay for college. And I know a lot of kids who are faking it till they make it in regards to the ex-gay thing with their parents, and they just don't want to rock the boat. But as far as I know, he's got good friends and people are really close to him, and I believe he's a college student this fall. And there's a new film coming out, What Does Love in Action Look Like? It's a film that I'm helping to produce, and it's about those summer, that summer protest and what to took place and how just a handful of people getting together and speaking out and people telling their stories, how that could make a difference. Because this summer we found out that the Love in Action Refuge program that took in youth has been discontinued. And we know a lot of it had to do with the sort of pressure they got from the activists and from the behind-the-scenes work that we did. So although Love in Action still runs for adults, that youth program has been shut down. And instead, they've got a weekend intensive for parents, 4 days, $600 a parent, to go and try to figure out why your kid's gay, and now they're targeting the parents, but at least the kids are not being forced to attend against their will.
Wow, you guys are just incredible guests, just incredible guests. Peterson, I need to say to you that just before you joined the Head On Radio Network chat room, all of the folks were demanding that I ask you to please email me so that I can let everyone know when the DVD is available of your stage performance, Do It in Time and Homo Nomo, and I'm sure we would also like to know the release date of the video that you just discussed. Please don't forget us on that. Sincerely were demanding, and I would have asked anyway, quite frankly. I'm just telling you, there's a whole gang backing me up here. It's 10:55. I'll probably have to wrap out at 10:58 in about three more minutes, so I need to give you a time warning. I don't want to just say, I got to go, bye. But I wanted to leave it open. What would you, I'm going to ask you individually, I'll start with Christine. Christine, what would you say to someone who is listening to this program and is struggling and considering going to one of these places? What resources would you offer them? What websites? How would you reach out to a lesbian who is hearing this?
I would say, you know, and honestly, not to be self-promoting whatsoever, but I would say to read all the stories on beyondxgay.com. Read what other people have, you know, who are in the exact same situation, what their stories have been like, because that'll give you a really good idea. You know, the other thing, I think, I know you're talking about resources, but, you know, I would just ask the question, why do you feel like it's necessary to change?
You're absolutely right. The stories, if you'll stop by beyondxgay.com, you are going to find stories there that will simply amaze you, which is one of the reasons earlier I so much wanted them told on this show. And again, I want to reiterate, if you would put the word out amongst your people, I would dearly love to have them on. Peterson, how would you react to, what would you say to a young gay man and save him perhaps 20 years of his life?
Well, definitely what Christine said. Check out the site. Also go to YouTube. There's a lot of great video there. And the other thing is, I would say, you know, for one, go to a non-Christian counselor, just a neutral person who's not going to have an agenda. You know, a professional counselor is not going to push you one way or another. They're going to try to help hear you out. But also, I'd ask them to figure out, either through journaling, through talking, unwrap and unearth all of the reasons why they want to change. And if it comes down to because it would make your life easier, it would make your relationships better with your parents, if it would please other people, well, those are all the wrong reasons to deny yourself who you are. Those are go counter to even what the scriptures say. And I would say, if you're a Christian, spend time alone with God, just seeking God and listening, and really saying, what do you want me to do with my life? And shut out all that other noise that you're hearing, particularly from society, saying that you've got to be fixed, you've got to be changed.
Very good advice. You know, you guys have been some of the most remarkable guests. I don't think I've seen reactions in the chat room like this in a long time. You're doing a wonderful thing, and again, I would like to lend my support in any way I can as a streaming internet radio show. Either of you, at any time you like, please pick up the phone and call the toll free number. It's there at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. I'll put you on the air. I'll put your members on the air. These are stories that desperately need to be told. You would be amazed at the number of emails and the interest that I'm receiving from this. In addition to that, the archive for this program will be posted by some point tomorrow morning. I will email you the direct link. Christine, I don't know if I have your mail, but I'm sure Peterson will forward it to you. Yep. So that you'll have a direct link to the archive. And the archive will also be available at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. You're welcome to download an archive, that archive, and edit it and use it in any way that you wish. And so I really must go. There's another show coming up. I love you guys, and thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Good evening. Good evening to both of you. And so Cynthia Manley can't make it tonight. She's on vacation. So I'm just going to remind you to stand, and I'm going to also remind you to stay tuned for Cup of Joe. That is our friend Joe Vecchio, who will be joining us in just a few minutes at 11 p.m. for the nighttime Cup of Joe. Also want to remind you to please remain on for the midnight showing of John Fox's feature. It's the Midnight Rocky Horror John Fox Show. Actually, it's Foxed Up, all Foxed Up with John Fox. And good evening to you all.